Blog Talk Radio.
This is JJ Bomber. You are listening to Well Armed Radio.
Good evening, sheepdogs. Welcome to Well-Armed Radio, where freedom is our best friend. Thank you for joining us in our weekly vigorous and many times ruthless pursuit of freedom. We are broadcasting live from the extraordinarily well-armed studio in New Berlin, Wisconsin. My pleasure to speak with the most informed gun owners in the state. That would be you guys. You are your community's finest. And with the face for radio and a voice for silent movies, my name is Nick Clark. I'm the president of Wisconsin Carry and the host of Well-Armed Radio. Just a free man trying to stay afloat in the sea of communism. And encourage you to be a part of the show tonight with your calls, ideas, questions, comments, criticism, participation. So the number to reach the show is 563-999-3787. We'll get you through to the Well-Armed Studio. 563-999-3787. You can also interact with the show by using the chat, which Lon from Wausau is doing tonight. Lon, great to have you in. And you can also interact with the show via, I think people who are on phones can't use the chat because I think that operates off a flash or something. I never use the phone to access the show, but that's what I've been told. So the Well-Armed Radio MeWe page is another option, MeWe.com/P/Well-Armed Radio. And then I kind of try to keep one eye on the Wisconsin Carry group page as well on MeWe, but the best way is in the show episode link on the Well-Armed Radio page on MeWe. I keep an eye on that one, and I'll see it if you make a comment there. Otherwise, as many of you know, and those of you listening know, most of the people listen to the podcast, not the live show. But I'm hoping that, now that fall/winter has set in, I'll be a little bit more regular with my times here, and certainly for the next few weeks, because we've got a special broadcast tonight and a special broadcast for the duration of the Kyle Rittenhouse case. We're going to be, we've got a special guest tonight who will be a guest with us hopefully every Sunday as he's available, who I'll introduce in a moment. But we've got special coverage of the Kyle Rittenhouse case in so much as I believe this case should have never been charged. It's still a fascinating case. I say I'm looking forward to it. I'm still nervous for Kyle, but I mean, I'm looking forward to the case because I'm hoping for good things. It's fascinating to me. It's interesting to me. It's unfortunate. I mean, it's mixed emotions. But we're going to have these special broadcasts for the next. I think they said that the case is going to last 2 weeks, but for as long as it takes. This obviously the trial starts tomorrow, Monday, November 1st. Which is coincidentally, I believe, the 10-year anniversary of the 10-year anniversary of Wisconsin starting to issue concealed carry licenses. I'm pretty sure November 1st was either the day they started issuing them or the day they started accepting applications. I can't remember which it was, but November 1st, 2011, I believe, was when the Wisconsin's concealed carry law, quote, took effect, Act 35. So start the show with the usual warning, no sacred cows here. And we'll skip open lines tonight. Usually the first 50 minutes of the show is open line, but I put aside 2 hours tonight. I don't know how long it's going to take us. I've got quite a bit to get through. We've got quite a bit to get through. And so with no further ado, let's see, did I get all the intro stuff in? I said how to interact the show. Yeah, I think we're good to go here. So I am going to bring live now a special guest who's going to, I guess I'll call him co-host. Kevin Mathewson has joined us now. Kevin is lives in Kenosha. A little bit of background. Well, first, Kevin, welcome to Well Armed Radio.
Hey, good evening. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. No, it's truly my pleasure to have you, and the audience is fortunate to have you here. You're a bit of a local expert in affairs down in Kenosha. Just for a little bit of background for the listeners, Kevin is a criminal defense investigator in Kenosha. Kevin also is the editor and special investigative journalist with the Kenosha County Eye, and he does a great job with the website and the reporting that they do there and covered some. It's one of my, you know, it's with just the pathetic saturation propaganda news that's both national and local. There's the best places for news are not the television station anymore, and so I enjoy the Kenosha Eye website. I think it's KenoshaCountyEye.com, correct, Kevin?
That's correct.
So, I mean, I get the email updates, and then I tend to read those whenever they come through, just stories that you wouldn't get in other places. And that's, I say it's unfortunate. It's a free market, you know, free market of ideas. And so it's, this is how we, you know, if you want to call us conservatives or us freedom-minded folks, have to get information out there in the absence of news media that does any kind of objective rational coverage. So a little bit more on Kevin. He's was a two-term Kenosha alderman, lives in Kenosha, was in Kenosha obviously during the Kenosha riots of over a year ago now. That was, I believe, August of 2020. So he'll have a unique perspective. I believe, Kevin, from our conversations, you're planning to be in the courtroom most of the trial. And I'm maybe going to start with that. Because I've seen you at some of the hearings, and that's kind of what gave me the idea to invite you to co-host with me here for the next few weeks when this trial is going on. Start us off with that, because we're going to talk about the case in a second, but let's start with that. How have the hearings been? Have they been, I mean, obviously there's media there. Do you anticipate a packed courtroom with COVID protocols? Are they going to limit the people? What are you seeing and what are you expecting there?
So as far as COVID protocols, this is an old school judge. He's been a judge for over 40 years.
And this is Schrader. This is just for the audience. His last name is Schrader.
Bruce Schroeder. Yep,
Bruce Schroeder. Yeah.
He's been a judge for over 40 years. Fairly conservative in the literal sense of the meaning. He's not going to require masks, thank God. And in fact, if you want to wear a mask, you have to wear a mask that's issued by the court. So they have those generic blue surgical masks that probably don't do anything except for make people feel a little better. But he doesn't want any masks with any terms or positions one way or the other. And I think it's going to be packed. So this past Friday, there was a media walkthrough at the courthouse. So CNN, NBC, CBS, and all the Main Street media were there. I was there, of course, some local outlets. So the way they're going to do it is every day it's going to be a lottery system. So the first 2 days that they anticipate to be the jury selection, there will be 6 spots in the courtroom for media that they will select at random with a lottery. And I think there's at least 25 journalists in that pool, and then after the first 2 days it'll be 10 drawings each day. So I don't know which days I'll be allowed in the courtroom or not. However, there is a media room that will have live stream all the camera angles and have full audio access, as well as there will be a reporter pool. So every day that I'm not in the courtroom, I'll get the notes from whoever was in the courtroom that day. And of course I'm welcome to sit just like anybody can in the general public area. And I believe the capacity of the courtroom is about 150. I would imagine it being a little less. There'll be some folks that'll want to keep space in between each other, but I know Kyle's allowed four family members or friends. Each quote-unquote victim will be allowed four family members, the pedophile, the career criminal, and the other career criminal. Two deceased, one still alive, Gage Grosskreutz. So they'll each get four people, some room for court staff and DA staff, and then the rest will be first come, first serve public.
And so that's 150 about-ish of the first come, first serve public. So do you anticipate, so with the press, so can the press go just sit in the general seating area if they don't get picked in the lottery, or how is that going to work?
Yeah, so the press, obviously were cheated just like regular citizens that want to go and watch. And what I will say, which is surprising, is each and every pretrial conference that I've been at, it's only been media and people directly involved. There haven't been many spectators, which surprised me, but almost leads me to believe there's not going to be a whole lot of people that just want to watch this trial, because this is a judge that's not going to take any crap and, you know, people sighing or cheering or clapping, that's not going to be tolerated. So that could weed some folks out too. Security is going to be really tough. Us in the media, we have parking passes, but they're going to shut down part of the road in front of the courthouse. So they're going to be ready, hopefully. And it'll just be a matter of what days, you know, I get lucky and get to, you know, be right in the front row of the courtroom. But either way, I'll be able to spectate and listen to what's going on and
so
see what being will be up to.
So the press gets the front spots in the room, and then I assume cameras, those will most be around the perimeter. And there's the court. Are television cameras allowed in, or only the court's own feed cameras are allowed in?
That so that's the cooler. As of right now, the court's feed cameras are not going to be activated. Those are the feeds that you can get from the Wisconsin Supreme Court website. Court TV has three tripod cameras set up, one behind the judge that will get the prosecutor's tables, and then there's two in the back of the court. One will be for the witness and the judge, and I believe the other one will be for exhibits. Every time they play a video for the jury, that's the one camera angle. Obviously, all feeds in raw form will go to all of those other broadcast journalists, and then they'll stream them however they wish. But I think TV is going to have it live every day.
And it's, I mentioned this to you, I think, in our pre-show comment. I mean, for me, this is going to be like the Olympics, where like I'm going to have it on in my office and watch it all day. It's kind of must-see television for me. The couple of things, everybody is familiar. I don't think we need to go and rehash the whole event itself, though there's certainly probably pieces, especially the people that are going to be tuning into this show probably have a pretty good baseline of what happened that night. But I think what would be helpful for some people is just to restate and people have seen the videos. They might not know who was in the videos, but essentially everybody knows the story. But to set the table here, Kyle was in Kenosha. He had been there earlier in the day, or maybe it was the day before, or something, helping with graffiti. Really nice kid, for if you've watched any videos of him or whatever. Just a really nice kid, young. You know, when you're young, sometimes young and passionate, and sometimes young naive, maybe is a word to describe, you know, people of his age. That, but just, you know, I think that this is speculation. I haven't talked to Kyle, obviously, but I have talked to reporters. In fact, I talked to Bruce from the Journal Sentinel last week, and, you know, Kyle did what a lot of us, I think, wish that we could have done. And that was, I saw the gentleman who owns a mattress store with a fire extinguisher trying to protect his business. And look, if you own a mattress store in Kenosha and you're 70 years old and you're out there during a riot trying to protect it, you're not a wealthy guy. You may worry what insurance will or won't do. And then to see that guy get, I think, smashed in the head with a brick or whatever for just trying to protect his business, that's the kind of thing that, like, boiled my blood. And I can't help but think that's the kind of thing that Kyle saw and people like Kyle saw and said, I got to do something. Kids that were in high school, as seniors in high school during 9/11, they just saw that and they go out and enlist the next day. You know, people that saw what happened in Kenosha, they saw that, and some knew it was coming, and they wanted to be there for that reason to help and provide protection. But that's how I would describe what my perception is Kyle sees this and is going to go to Kenosha to help. He knew someone was associated with people who had a business there. He was going to help protect that business. But what I wanted to, so to set the table for people, maybe a little bit more detail, where we're at right now. The first video people see Kyle getting chased across the parking lot of the auto dealership place. The person chasing him there, that's Rosenbaum, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So Rosenbaum is the one chasing him across. There's another protester participant in the events that night who fired the first shot that night. And I think his name was, his last name starts with a Z. Do you remember that?
Joshua Zeminski.
So the first shot that was fired, Kyle's running away from Rosenbaum, who Rosenbaum, I mean, you've seen, anybody has probably seen the videos of him too. You know this, but set the table for people, Rosenbaum's background. Who is this Rosenbaum guy?
So Rosenbaum had just got out of what he calls jail that same day, August 25th. But really, it was a mental institution. It was a secure facility, obviously for criminal behavior and severe mental health issues. And he's the gentleman who was convicted of sexually assaulting, I think, at least three boys. So this is not a good dude. This is a bad dude who probably looks for trouble. He found it on August 25th, that's for sure.
He's a
convicted pedophile, sex offender. I mean, just somebody that the world will not miss.
Interestingly, pretrial hearings, that's one of the things that they're not going to allow is for prejudicial reasons. Although some people in the jury may have already heard it, and certainly, and we don't know who's in the jury yet, but just like some people in the jury might have heard some other things, that the judge isn't going to allow the video of Kyle sitting outside of a drugstore when it looks like it's being robbed and making a comment about the robber in that situation. But
yes,
so the jury likely won't hear anything about Rosenbaum, his background, that he's a sex offender, pedophile, convicted felon. They're likely not going to hear any of that, correct?
That's correct. And, you know, and that just goes to show that Schrader is a very fair judge. And as much as if I were the judge, I'd love to let the jury hear that this guy was a disgusting pedophile. It's not fair because if this was anything other than self-defense, if this guy was murdered in cold blood, it wouldn't matter that he was a pedophile, because even though he's a pedophile, he doesn't deserve to die unless, of course, he was attacking a 17-year-old child.
And the thing here, the judge's thought process is, which in the legal thought process too, is some people on the jury might be like, oh, pedophile? Yeah, you know, I don't have any sympathy for him, you know. So that's the reason that would be prejudicial. So Rosenbaum is chasing Kyle across the thing. I'm so sick of hearing the news say Rosenbaum was unarmed or whatever. I mean, he had a bag of chemical. It was essentially a Molotov. Like when I hear him, they threw a plastic bag at Rittenhouse. It was a bag filled with chemical, I don't know if it was ammonia laced with something or if it was supposed to be a Molotov cocktail type device, but that's what he was running across, chasing after Kyle with, because he was mad that Kyle was putting out fires and preventing him from creating all this mayhem that this angry sex offender pedophile felon was doing there in Kenosha that night. So he goes chasing, go ahead.
And what you're going to hear during the trial is, I believe there's going to be at least two witnesses that will testify that they heard Rosenbaum say, if I catch that kid alone later, I'm going to kill him.
Yeah.
So that just goes to show you his state of mind that night.
Yeah, and that'll be powerful testimony. So that's the first actor. So now Rosenbaum chased after Rittenhouse. When that kind of goes off video, you hear the shots. Kyle, then you see this on video. Kyle is standing there until starts to call someone on his phone, until you hear people in the video say, you know, get him. Kyle's worried about his safety. So he takes off running down the street. And then as he's running down the street, this is the next video that people see. Does he does he trip himself, or does someone, the first person that runs after him kind of gives him like the, is it the kid with the skateboard that gives him the kick? Who's that kid, and what's the first person that...
So I'm just going to back you up just for a second here to that first shooting. One thing we got to make sure we don't let people forget is that while Kyle was running away from Rosenbaum, that's when Josh Zeminski shoots his gun in the air. So from Kyle's perspective, he heard a gunshot behind him as he's being followed. So that really goes to Kyle's state of mind. He's running from this guy who said at least twice that he wants to kill the guy, and then he hears a gunshot behind him. I mean, if that doesn't freak somebody out, I don't know what would. So that's
doesn't
an
know
important
who, doesn't know who fired the gun, doesn't know that that wasn't Rosenbaum
right.
firing at him.
For all he knows, Rosenbaum had a gun. A lot of people on both sides were armed that night. So that definitely goes to his state of mind. He's being chased. He's kind of in a dead end where there's cars everywhere. He trips. He hears a gunshot. I don't know what reasonable person wouldn't be in fear for their life, but...
And that's a key point, because reasonable is in when we talk about the justified use of deadly force, it was the belief that your life was in danger. Was that belief reasonable? And certainly with a gun being fired behind you as you're being chased, that would give all kinds of reason and make that a reasonable belief on Kyle's behalf.
Yep, absolutely.
So then moving down to the next video, when he's running away, running towards the police to you know, surrender, to turn himself in for safety, for all the, you know, we can't speculate exactly what he was looking for, but he was running in the direction of police. The first person that encounters him, that's the skateboard kid, correct?
Yeah, so I actually interviewed yesterday a man by the name of Nathan DeBruin, who was 10 feet from these two shots. When I said to the second two, so Anthony Huber and Gage Grossgraves, and he actually told me he saw Anthony Huber first throw the skateboard at Kyle, and then he ran after him, picked it up, and that's when he kind of used the blunt, you know, the skinny end of the skateboard and hit him right in the neck head area,
yep.
which could have been lethal or could have caused great bodily harm easily. A heavy skateboard to the back of the neck is cause for concern, definitely.
Yeah, and so Huber was the first person to, and it was his actions that tripped Kyle, correct?
That's I think that's probably going to come out in the evidence. I don't know for sure, but I've spoken to at least two people who think that. Huber caused him to trip and lose his footing.
And then, so Huber was the one swinging the skateboard, and then
yep.
he was the first person shot by Kyle in, again, what you and I believe is self-defense and what we believe will be
sure.
shown to be self-defense.
Absolutely.
The next person that approaches Kyle is this Gage, correct?
Gage Grosskreutz, correct.
Grosskreutz. This kid's a piece of work, too. I call him a kid.
Yeah.
He's from the Milwaukee, West Dallas area, I believe.
Yes.
He was down there that night doing what the other protesters are doing, being mad at the world or whatever.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about this guy.
So this guy has a very lengthy criminal history, as you probably would have guessed, ever since he was a young teen. First arrest I could find just before he turned 18 was for slapping around his grandma. He went through the juvenile court system, and for whatever reason, it's public record now, so that leads me to believe maybe he didn't finish his supervision or his parole, whatever his sentence was, because in Wisconsin, juvenile criminal records are not public knowledge, but we see that, so that's telling. We know that he was arrested for felony burglary. Him and some friends broke into another friend, so-called friend of theirs, house, stole some video game systems, pawned them, later was outsmarted by the police. You know, they had some tactics they used to, you know, especially somebody young like him at the time, easy to dupe. So he, criminal damage to property, criminal trespass to dwelling. And here's the what's ambiguous and what hopefully we'll find out eventually. So Gage was charged with the felony burglary, like I just talked about, and eventually he's arrested for DUI. And while he was driving drunk, 0.159, which is almost twice the legal limit, just 1/1000th of a point below that, they found a weapon on him. He was wanted, so they charged him with possession of a firearm by a felon. So at some point, it's safe to assume he was a felon, or at least there was something that made police believe he was a felon. And so whether that was expunged, some kind of hold open deal, we won't know. I was able to kind of use a loophole. One of his co-defendants was not given such leniency, so I have the criminal complaint for when he was arrested. And otherwise, there's all the court records for that have been sealed. After that, obstructing an officer, loud noise, prowling, and that prowling was from 2020. It was actually 9 days before he was in Kenosha. So we have a criminal history of 10 years, from 2010 to 2020.
And when Gage was in Kenosha, he was armed. He was armed when he was coming after Kyle, had the gun in his hand. Do we know?
Correct.
So that was he was not legally possessing that gun, or was he? Because he was not.
I think he was. This kid, he's kind of ballsy. He sent me a picture of his concealed carry card, and it looks genuine. I mean, I can't tell you that for sure, but
right,
you know,
we can't go create that database. So okay, so. So then Gage is coming at Kyle while Kyle's on the ground with and Gage has a gun in his hand.
Correct.
And Kyle shoots at him, and that's he hits him in the arm, kind of blows his bicep to pieces.
Yeah,
So what's
interesting, though, is that he kind of surrenders Gage. He kind of backs up, puts his gun in the air, and lets Kyle kind of lose focus. And then he goes back into the position of pointing the gun at Kyle. So it almost looked like he wanted to trick Kyle into, you know, trick him, and so he could shoot Kyle. And right when he pointed his gun back at Kyle, that's when he got shot. So Kyle gave him a chance. And
which is something that I think was remarkable about Kyle's behavior, is that he acted very textbook when it comes to use of deadly force, because when Gage backs up, he doesn't shoot Gage as he's backing up, because then that threat would not be imminent. I mean, the four key factors that justify use of deadly force is, one, be innocent of instigation. That means picking and looking for a fight. Two, this is not a legal requirement in Wisconsin, but retreat if possible. Kyle was trying to do that. He was trying to do that in the first place. He was trying to do it from Rosenbaum. He was trying to do it after that, going to the police. So then three, grave danger, great bodily harm must be imminent. And then four, no lesser force will do. Those are the four categories, the four qualifications, the four factors that have to be met to justify use of deadly force. That's what we teach in the concealed carry curriculum. So so he acts very, again, textbook when Gage comes at him and then retreats. He doesn't shoot him as he's retreating. Then he starts to come at him again. Then he, you know, uses his gun in defense of himself. This is one of the things that I say, and this is, we don't know, and maybe there'll be testimony to this effect, but when Gage and Anthony Huber, these two may have thought, because there was people yelling. I mean, you know, you don't know what they knew from the prior events of the night. Did they know who was who? There's so many people down there. Maybe they'd come across each other from there. So it's possible that these two thought that they were stopping a mass shooter or something. But this is what another thing that we teach in our concealed carry curriculum. If you come across a situation, and this is the you know, stereotypical thing we say, if you're walking down the street and you look down a dark alley and there's a guy in a suit and then a real disheveled looking guy with a gun pointed at him, and you step in because you can use your gun in defense of others. But if you're using your gun in defense of others, then those four conditions that justify the use of deadly force have to apply to them. But then we use this example in the concealed carry classes that, you know, if you walk into a situation that you don't know what's going on and you see a guy in scraggly clothing, a thug-looking guy pointing a gun at a guy in a suit, and you shoot the guy, the scraggly-looking guy that looks like a bum, he could be an undercover cop and the guy in the suit could be a well-dressed pimp. You just don't know. And so that doesn't make your actions legally justified to shoot that person or to act in that person's defense. So So it's possible that these guys thought, now Rosenbaum was just, he was a piece of garbage, and we know.
Yep.
So Rosenbaum, I don't speculate that he might have thought that, but even if Huber and Gage thought they were going to be heroes and stop a mass shooter, they were wrong in that thought, and that's not Kyle's fault that they, you know, were thinking that they were acting. Kyle would still, that wouldn't change the paradigm if Kyle was or wasn't justified, because their actions towards Kyle, that's what Kyle's self-defense was based upon.
Well, absolutely. And I think the theme with all three shootings are you see a kid who did not want to shoot anybody. You know, Rosenbaum, he was sprinting. He wanted to get out of there. He was scared. You know, he fell. He was cornered. He had no other choice. You know, if that pedophile would have grabbed the gun, Kyle wouldn't be here today. Then you have Kyle running down the street towards police. I mean, those armored personnel vehicles had red and blue flashing lights. That's where Kyle was running. And Gage and Huber should have known or did know that he was running towards law enforcement. Let him go. If he is this mass shooter that, you know, just killed some people, okay, he's heading towards law enforcement.
Yeah,
let them handle it, right? Don't put yourself in danger. And, you know, that is possible, you're right. But when you look at the totality of the circumstances and you look at these guys, how they're just, their whole lives, you know, Anthony Huber held a knife to his sister's throat because he didn't want to clean up the house. I mean, this is a guy who goes looking for trouble. So I think in these two cases, you can't give the benefit of the doubt to the guys that got shot. And, you know, that's not something that the jury's going to have. But me and you, two guys talking about it, we can't give the benefit of the doubt to these people who have just lived a life of violence and crime and hate.
And from my standpoint, it's I'm hearing that's the way the news is portraying it. But my point is that even if, which I don't believe it is, I don't believe for a second they thought they were stopping a mass shooter. But even if they did, that doesn't justify their actions. And that wouldn't be in the protocols that we teach with concealed carry and use of deadly force, they wouldn't be within those protocols because we talk about you have to know the situation you're going into, and that's why I use the situation of a well-dressed pimp and a scraggly-looking bum. And if you come across them and think the bum is holding up a businessman, that bum might be the undercover cop, and the guy in the suit might be the pimp that was just doing something illegal. And so even if, and I agree with you, I think that these guys are pieces of garbage and that's why they were in Kenosha doing what they were doing, because they're young, angry, lawless punks. But even if the news media and their portrayal that, they were trying to intervene and stop a mass shooter, that doesn't justify their actions, doesn't justify their behaviors. And it doesn't make what Kyle did any less justifiable self-defense. So
well, exactly. Cause you have to, the only mind the jury has to look at is Kyle's. They have to get into his mind. And one of the jury instructions says, we cannot look into the mind of Mr. Rittenhouse, but we have to look at the other circumstances that led him to where he was, including the gunshot he heard, including getting drop-kicked by that unidentified African-American man, including getting a skateboard thrown at him and then later with the sharp end hitting him in the neck, having somebody point a gun at you. I mean, this kid, if he wasn't scared, I lose faith in humanity. This was a scared child who was in a bad situation, probably shouldn't have been in, but you know what? He had every right to use lethal force, and if he didn't, he probably, his life would have been cut short pretty tragically, if you ask me.
The charges now here, so we've got there's the gun charge, which they've made a motion to drop. The judge initially said he was going to review that, and that still seems like that's kind of in limbo. So there's the charge. By how I read the statute, by how Wisconsin Carry's attorney has read the statute, by I've seen other legal experts do analysis, we believe that it's legal for him to have that gun at 17. At the age of 17, a short-barreled rifle would be illegal, but to have that gun doesn't in anything according to the statutes appear to be illegal to us. So so that's one charge that he's facing. I guess he's facing a curfew violation, and then there's the two murder charges, and then the I think reckless endangerment, or those are the charges that he's facing. So some initial observations that I thought, just as we look at this case, you think about landmark trials when it comes to self-defense, and this is certainly going to be one of them. And I think about, now I was only 10 at the time, but I liked older people stuff when I was a kid. I was 10 years old, and I remember the Bernie Goetz case in New York. For those who don't remember, Bernie Goetz was a subway rider. He had been previously mugged in the subways of New York. New York was a super high crime area. This was 1984. In the 80s, New York was a really, really bad place to be. He was on the subway one night, and then I'm going to get the details wrong here, but you can Wikipedia Bernie Goetz, but he shoots these people that attacked him on the subway that went to rob him. And then it became a huge thing there. He then took off, eventually turned himself in, but it was a very polarizing case in New York. There was people who said, look, with all the crime that's going on, and people need to defend themselves. And then I think he was acquitted with some charges, then recharged, and then found guilty of just the possession of the gun charge. So this is, as Bernie gets out in New York, it's a landmark case that people remember. And again, that's from the 80s. It was 84, I think. I was 10. I was born in 74. So, George Zimmerman is another landmark type of self-defense case that comes to mind. That's a more recent one. I forget what year that was, but down in Florida, Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman. I think this is up there with those. I don't know if there is any other ones that come to mind in your head as landmark self-defense type cases.
So that guy in New York, was that the guy who said something like, you know, how is that? Do you want another?
That was the one bad thing
about him. But yeah, he was acquitted, and people didn't like that. And, you know, people back then were on his side left and right because they were sick of all the crime that was going on in New York, you know. Just like New York, Kenosha is ran by a liberal Democrat, believe it or not.
And some people back during the Bernie Goetz case were very supportive of what he did. They said, look, crime is out of control here. And this guy had been, beaten to within an inch of his life previously. So then when this happened again, he knew what he could be in for because he'd previously been mugged and savagely beaten. So another observation I had here, Washington County, Waukesha County, Walworth County, I don't think this case even gets charged. Do you agree with that? Or at least not the murder?
In this case, you have an embattled DA. Gravely's been taking, and he's not just taking heat from one side or the other. I mean, the liberals hate him because he's charging Crystal Kaiser. And I'm sure you've heard about that case. It's a black 16-year-old who was having sex with this man for money. She felt victimized, allegedly. She later killed him and burned his house down. And Gravely's went full board, charged her with murder. So the left hates him. They hate him because he didn't charge Officer Rustin Chesky, right? And now he decides to politically prosecute Kyle. So now the right hates him. And he thought that this was going to make up or cancel the other things that the left hated him for. And it's just not going to happen. Yeah, other counties with competent prosecutors, no, there'd be no charge. There would have been an investigation, a sufficient investigation. I mean, this guy, there was a warrant for him, I think, the next day. I mean, I'm talking 24 hours. So you know, the police officer who shot Jacob Blake got the benefit of, what, a four-month investigation?
Oh, it was more than that. Yeah.
Yeah, many, many months. But with Rittenhouse, it's one day, okay, he's a murderer. So you're telling me you don't want to take some extra time before you charge this kid with multiple counts of homicide? It's just, it shows the double standard. You know, and I'm a supporter of good police officers, but they just get the benefit of the doubt times infinity as opposed to just the regular kid like Kyle.
I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to mention that too. The officer that shot Jacob Blake, and I believe after what everything we've heard that was a justified shooting, as did a black police chief who was the special investigator from Madison who agrees with you and me. Now I forget his name, Noble Ray, I believe, was the police chief from Madison who reviewed that. And he agrees that was a justified shooting. So But that, you know, I think it was more than 4 months, but they interviewed, I forget how many, this is for the Jacob Blake shooting. They talked about how many witnesses that there was, it was like, I don't know if it was hundreds, and I thought, look, Kyle Rittenhouse was charged in less than 24 hours when there was multiple videos, you know, a half dozen videos from three different scenes. You know, there's the scene prior, there's the initial interaction with Rosenbaum. There's the scene where he's a video where he's running across the parking lot and the first shot is fired by Zeminski or whatever. And then then he fires at Rosenbaum. Then there's the third scene down so multiple scenes, thousands of witnesses, and they charge him within 24 hours, Kyle Rittenhouse. Meanwhile, in a video with Jacob Blake, where there was two police officers, maybe a handful of people watching, a handful of people present, two police officers, and the whole thing was on one video. Actually, there was two videos. I believe there was two videos.
Yeah.
So two videos. They took a situation that was much more succinct, much more compact, and that took months and months and months to review, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of witnesses to interview. You couldn't have possibly interviewed hundreds of witnesses in 24 hours. I mean, this was charged immediately, and it was charged, you know, to placate. I mean, I don't know if they thought they were going to, I don't know what the DA was thinking, and you might have, you know, you have some perspective, you thought about that, but it's just, you know, again, I think the point that I wanted to make, Waukesha, Washington, Walworth County, the case almost certainly isn't even charged. Next thing I wanted to say here, because Bruce Belmetti from the Journal Sentinel asked me this question. He's like, the right has kind of taken Kyle on as like a hero. And I said, well, I don't know. Hero is a tough word. Some people might use it. I don't use it. I think hero is thrown around too much as it is. But, you know, hero or no, I think it's hard to say hero because having to take someone's life that – you know, if you stop a mass shooting, that's heroic. Defending yourself, is it heroic? I mean, it's unfortunate when you have to take someone's life in self-defense, but it's better than being, you know, killed unjustly. So I think there's some chest thumpers that'll call Kyle a hero. I don't throw the word hero on. I don't call him a hero for having to kill someone. I do call him brave and principled for going to Kenosha to help. You know, he saw the same video that you and I did and everybody else did of a 70-year-old mattress store owner getting clobbered in the head, knocked unconscious with a brick as he's trying to save his burning store from looters.
71 years old that man was.
Yeah, and people couldn't take it. So, I mean, I say God bless Kyle for wanting to help. Whatever you heard or perceive of Kenosha during these riots from the news, I mean, it was worse. So that's the next thing I want to ask you, someone who lives in Kenosha, because I have a friend who lives in Kenosha, and she was scared to death. I mean, I don't know how close she was to that. I mean, she lives in city proper, and she was scared to death. I know other people that said they just stayed up all night. Everybody in the house that had a gun, was armed, and they were guarding their own houses. Give some perspective to the listeners on that, because I think people, if they think that this was just like a couple block area where that's where it took place, and if you were five blocks away, you weren't worried about it. I mean, it was lawlessness in Kenosha that night.
Yeah, so unfortunately, I played kind of a big role in these 3 days. So to give you some context, after the shooting, I was there pretty quick. I wanted to see what was going on. Obviously, I saw the video that you've seen, and half the world has seen of this police officer shooting this man in the back. Obviously, we didn't have any of the details, but you know, we had the governor who jumped to conclusions right away and said, oh, just another black man being shot by a white police officer. So he kind of blamed the fires. And I was there for a few minutes maybe an hour with a friend of mine. And then you wouldn't believe how quickly the numbers doubled and tripled. And that's when, if you can recall, Captain Ham of the Kenosha Police got hit in the head with a flying brick. Got knocked unconscious and ended up getting a concussion. They started to let the airs out of the tires, smash the windows. I got out of there
This is kind of like the first night, right? The day
the 23rd.
Was he shot on a Sunday, Jacob Blake?
Yep, Sunday the 23rd.
Yep. So this is the first night this is already going to hell in the handbasket, Kenosha.
Yep. Yep, so that's Sunday night. And Sunday night, a lot of buildings burned down. And so I have my Am I also a security contractor, which I do less than criminal defense investigating, but I was hired by a business who had already been looted because their insurance company says, hey, look, we want to mitigate some damages. So from about, I want to say 11 at night till about 6 in the morning, I just, you know, guarded a business. You know, it was not, it was uneventful, thank God. My wife was a little nervous. And then, you know, tons of buildings burnt. And so that was the inner city. They call it Uptown. And that's actually where me and my wife lived after we were married. And that's where both of my kids were born, in that Uptown area. And this is not an affluent area. So these scumbags were burning down homes of poor people. So, you know, you won't hear it in the media, but these were homes that were burnt down. You know, the Uptown area, the first floor, their businesses, second, third, sometimes in some instances, fourth floor, are all residential areas. These are poor people, and their homes burnt down. You know, the media says, oh, it's just businesses, it's just property, no big deal. Whenever you burn down a business that has three residential floors above it, you're risking life or serious bodily injury, right? So it kind of hit home to me because that's where I used to live. And so I live in a subdivision on the west side of the city where these thugs on Facebook were saying, hey, let's hit these, what they call, you know, rich neighborhoods. I'm just a middle class working guy. My wife and I work hard for our money. You know, we live in a modest home on, you know, in one of these cookie cutter subdivisions. But there were threats all over social media about, hey, let's get these rich people and stuff. So there was certainly a threat to people anywhere in the city, whether you're downtown, uptown, on the west side, north side. It was a scary time for anybody who lived anywhere near this area.
People flooding in off the interstate, coming in.
Yep.
In fact, I think they closed some exit ramps at some time, didn't they?
Yep.
So, I mean, yeah, people think that, you know, if you were 20 blocks away, it was no big deal. It wasn't like that. There was people all over the place. You're at a gas station, there's people coming in, filling up gas cans at gas stations that they're not going to, and this is at, you know, whatever time of night, they're not going to mow lawns. They're not landscapers. I mean, they were ready to cause mayhem. And the people.
Fun fact about that, those are the riot kitchen people, if you remember.
Yeah.
Police department, the ATF, the FBI, they referred tons of criminal charges. DA Gravely did not charge one of them with not one crime.
Unbelievable. It's safe to say that the people of Kenosha, I mean, they were scared to death. I mean, there was runs on guns. You couldn't find a gun. And guns were already in short supply because of, you know, just the times that we live. And George Floyd, people start buying guns. Anytime anything happens, people are smart enough to realize that, look, I'm the only one I can count on for my self-defense. So, but you go to guns, local stores, I mean, they were sold out of guns. But people were scared. Border to border, from Lake Michigan to the interstate, people were scared. I mean, that's an accurate assessment, correct?
Yep, absolutely.
And I bring this up because that's where the jury pool is coming from. This is, you know, the jury pool is going to come from Kenosha County. We'll get to that in a second here, but you know, this is to me again such a fundamental Second Amendment case because there's no point in owning a gun or carrying a gun if you can't use it without going to jail, and there's no deterrent factor if thugs know that you're afraid to use it or will likely be the one in trouble if you use it. Think about in Milwaukee, we see videos of people taunting the police, and they're still doing it now when the police can chase. But these criminals, these thugs, they, when there was a no chase policy, they knew they weren't going to be chased, and so that emboldened them to do these kinds of things. If one of the things that the reason that self defense works so well for me, for you, for all the armed concealed carry license holders and the armed open carriers and the armed constitutional carriers out there, is because we have the upper hand in the criminal, because not only are we able to be armed, but we're legally allowed to use that gun. The criminal cannot legally use their gun to attack us. We can legally use our gun to defend ourselves. And so for that reason, we, the law-abiding, have the upper hand. But if the law-abiding are going to be persecuted for using their gun in self-defense, I mean, I've always said, please God, if I ever have to use my gun in self-defense, and I hope I never do, please don't let it be of a person of color, because that just raises the stakes in this race hyper sensationalized, hyper, amped up society that we live in.
Well, that's the thing is, sorry to interrupt, but if you look at all these headlines from all these left-wing media organizations, they keep talking about race and white supremacy. This is the only time I've ever heard something described as being motivated by race when you have one white guy who shoots three white guys. It makes no logical sense. So to what you're saying, if this would have been three African-Americans or three Hispanic folks, oh my God, can you imagine how worse this would be, how more of an uphill battle this would have been for Kyle?
And that makes me wonder if the left needs riots. And that's why, because the left needs riots and unrest, and they can't have, and I think if this would have happened in a Waukesha or a Washington County, Washington County, Waller County, and that, and Kyle doesn't get charged, what a chilling factor that would have had on looters and rioters. Because it would have been saying, well, look, this is, and maybe it has anyway, because, it's, look, you come to loot and riot. It's not just a night of fun and the purge that you see on a TV show, which seems glamorous. You know, people could lose their lives if you attack people and that you hit a 71-year-old in the head with a brick and you might be dead. But the left, that's what the left has with this. See, this one, I think that I can't say the grassroots but the race hustling crowd doesn't have a big piece of this in terms of the racial angle, but they have a piece of it in terms of the interest in preserving the tactic of rioting, because the tactic of rioting isn't successful, if the tactic of rioting would result in people suffering consequences of their illegal and violent actions, you wouldn't have all these people that treat it like a fun, because there's people there that I think of it as a wilding night, and then there's people who are really out to do as much damage as they possibly can because they're angry, at the world type individuals. But for me, it's such a fundamental Second Amendment case because, I mean, protecting yourself or your business or a business in a riot situation that's quintessential Second Amendment kind of stuff. It's the kind of thing that everybody thinks about. Civil unrest is the kind of thing that everybody thinks about when wanting to be armed. And defensive use of a gun, 90% of the time, a gun doesn't have to be fired to protect you in self-defense. You pull the gun, thug runs away. Thug doesn't want anything to do with that. But if a pattern gets established that you're going to be persecuted for legally using a gun, let me say morally using a gun in self-defense, I think it would chill the right to carry. I think there's people that wouldn't carry. And I think that those who do will have to think twice. And thugs could, kind of call your bluff, because if you're afraid to use your gun in self-defense because you think even if you do everything right, you're going to be persecuted, prosecuted. I mean, so I think the deterrent factor is critical. And that's why, again, you almost never have to shoot a gun in self-defense to successfully defend yourself. But if we start chipping away at that by throwing people in jail who use their gun in a morally justified way, then that does give that upper hand to the criminals. You pull a gun, the criminal's like, yeah, you want to go to jail? You want to go to jail? You shoot me, you know you're going to jail. So while we can't lionize Kyle for killing someone, I think we can lionize him for his bravery and his principles. And I think this is a hugely important case in that regard. But I said this when Bruce Valetti from the Journal Sentinel was interviewing me earlier in the week. I said, I think about this. A young person on the left does something bold, like Greta Thunberg or David Hogue, and they get canonized by the left. I mean, hell, thugs get canonized by the left. George Floyd was a druggy thug, and he gets treated like a saint by the left. Jacob Blake sexually assaults a woman. This is the precipitating factor for this Kenosha riot. Jacob Blake sexually assaulted a woman by jamming his finger inside of her, pulling it out and saying, it smells like you've been with another man. That's why he got arrested. And then he violated the restraining order. This guy was a piece of shit. This guy was a piece of garbage. And then he violated the restraining order that he was arrested for what he did to her. And then he resisted arrest, pulled a knife on the cops, tried to steal her car and kidnap her kids. They were his kids as well. But he's been lionized, glorified by the media and celebrities alike. I don't know if it's millions, but hundreds of thousands of dollars donated for him. And then I think, you know, I said it to Bruce Lametti. I said, you know, I can't call Kyle a hero because he for having to kill someone, but I'd say brave and principled. But so not a hero, but we shouldn't be afraid to support Kyle because he's a noble person in my view of what his intentions were, and he deserves to have the admiration and support that the left undeservedly gives to these people that they want to turn into martyrs and use for their, you know, for their political endeavors. So I don't know how you're doing for time, but I got a couple more questions that I wanted to go through with you. Pre-trial motions and hearings, some things that have come out so far, jump in here when you, because you've been intimately observing these. The deceased can't be referred to as victims. That's one of the rulings that Bruce, that Judge Schroeder has made. The deceased,
and just to be clear, that's his standing directives for all attorneys for every case. That's how he's been for 40 years. And this is, again, this just goes to show that he's fair and impartial. He doesn't want anybody, even in a case where you have a homicide with a confession, he will not allow prosecutors to refer to the deceased as victims, because when you call somebody a victim, you're admitting that they were the victim of a crime, that there was a crime that was committed. So this has been his policy for many, many years.
Other pretrial motions, the videos that the media has made sure that have been plastered all across the, you know, the news universe, the videos of, there's one video with Kyle and some interaction with, I think it was his sister and some scuffle. There's another video outside of a convenience Walgreens or CVS or something. Those will not be allowed in court. Again, although they're already in the court of public opinion, but those will not be allowed in court.
Right.
One of the things I was going to say there is this is a reminder to people, you know, we always say this, we said it on social media before, but watch what you say on social media. It will come back to haunt you, even if it's not in court itself, which sometimes it may well end up in court itself. But these, I say to people, you know, that sticker on your front door that says we don't call 911. Maybe that's not a good idea. I mean, maybe that's the first thing when you have to use your gun in self-defense and they're there taking pictures at your house, don't think that that's a non-factor. So the pretrial motions, pretrial hearings, and this fabricated, concocted association with the Proud Boys, that's not something relevant for trial. They're not going to allow that. And again, I have my experiences with the Proud Boys have been nothing but positive. I was at Sheriff Clark's rally up in Wauwatosa. They were great, respectful people that were very helpful. I mean, so I don't buy into the media characterizations of the Proud Boys. But even with that said, the judge has prohibited any, because that was after the from last August, Kyle was at a bar after one of his hearings. Some people that were members of the Proud Boys were there. That's been covered on the news, but that's not going to be allowed as part of the, because it's irrelevant to the, you know, I think the judge said, unless you can prove that Kyle had some association with them prior to the night in question, which there's no evidence of that. So, and then one other one, the defense may call, the defense can call the deceased rioters or looters. But explain that one to us, because is that just in closing arguments if there's evidence introduced to support it?
Once again, a lot of the mainstream media got that wrong. He didn't give the defense a blanket permission to just say, riot or some looters. What he said was, is if there's evidence that you're going to introduce, like, for example, you know, Rosenbaum had a chain and is on video lighting fires. Those are not really things that you can have a logical explanation for it. So if you want to say he was an arsonist and you can show that this is true, you can refer to him as that. You know, it would kind of be no different than, you know, can we refer to somebody as, you know, a boy or an adult. I mean, if it quacks like a duck, it's a duck, right? So it wasn't a blanket permission to just, instead of referring to one of the deceased as Mr. Rosenbaum, he can say, oh, the looter, the rioter. It's not like the media would have you believe, but the judge basically said, if you can prove that, then you can refer to them in limited circumstances. I think he either said, I believe he said they can't refer to those words in closing arguments, only during the evidence portion of the trial, if I remember that correctly.
Any other, anything else from the hearings that have taken place so far that we haven't talked about that you think is pertinent?
So the prosecution, Binger right away asked for a gag order. The judge never ruled on that. So apparently the judge didn't think a gag order was appropriate. And I think that was kind of a way for Binger, because he's very cunning, remember. I mean, I know your organization has dealt with him in the past. He wanted to silence the defense from being able to put out, you know, Kyle's getting assassinated everywhere. You know, as a murderer, people still think he crossed
white
state
supremacist
lines at night.
Yeah,
people still think he's a white supremacist. They think his mother dropped him off, drove him from Antioch to Kenosha. Well, no, we've all known he was in Kenosha that whole day. He was scrubbing graffiti off the wall. So what the prosecution basically wanted was his character to get assassinated in the public realm, but they didn't want the defense to be able to respond to that and say, no, that's not true. And I will say the defense team has not been making many, if any, statements to the press anyways, but he never took up that. Another interesting pretrial request from the defense, from the prosecution, was they wanted the judge to prohibit them from calling a police officer named Amanda Franco. So there were some stories written about these. They call them, when I was a dispatcher, they called them MDCs. I don't know what that acronym stands for, but they're the computers that cops have in their cruisers, and they can type messages.
MDTs, mobile data terminal.
So what happens is those cops were typing to each other and saying, hey, these armed citizens are polite. You know, they're using good restraint. They seem professional. They have good behavior with handling their weapons. They were basically praising a lot of these armed individuals. And Amanda Franco was one of those who said, look, I talked to Kyle several times that night. I didn't know who he was at the time, but now I know who he is. And he was very, I forgot the word she used, but, you know, he was cordial, you know, in my interactions with him, right? And this is a police officer that was on duty that was blocks away from where the shootings happened. And Tom Binger was arguing, till he was red in the face, that she's an irrelevant witness, and she should be prohibited from being called, right? This is a person that was right there. I was at home in bed sleeping during the riots, and they wanted to put me on the witness list. So it's just so.
Binger wants to bring in evidence from Kyle going to a bar months later. That Proud Boys happened to be there, but yeah, the people that were there that night, he doesn't want to. I mean, and you said Binger's a piece of work as well. I mean, Wisconsin City ran up against him with Guy Smith, the trial down in Kenosha, which I was a truck driver. After our attorney schooled him in court, he asked the judge, mercifully granted him an adjournment or a recess so that he could spend some more time investigating the statutes that our attorney knew better than he did. Because I think he walked into Guy Smith's trial thinking that he was like a cop, or like walking into someone who's going to fight their parking or their speeding ticket. You're going to walk all over him, and the judge is going to be all on your side. And when the judge took our attorney Monroe's argument that what Guy Smith did wasn't illegal, Binger was just just floundering, and so they gave him a merciful extension to or recess to come back in a future date. And when they did, Guy comes down. Actually, Guy stays at my house, so he didn't have to spend on a hotel. Stays at my house. Monroe flies in, go down there for the morning of trial, and there goes Binger. Oh, we're going to drop the charges, Judge, which he could have done days, weeks before, and he didn't. He just wanted to be an asshole and get Wisconsin Carries paying the expenses to have John flown in and get Guy down from Wausau, make Guy lose a day of work, and then just to drop the charges. And so, I mean, I don't know anything about Binger other than those experiences and what I've seen, but I just think maybe I'm naive that I think even if you're a prosecutor, like, you could still be a decent person. And
well, that's just the thing. And Binger ran for DA in Racine County, I want to say maybe 10 years ago, as a Democrat, of course. He's a bleeding heart, and he got his ass kicked. And so now he comes back and he's working for the DA's office here in Kenosha, and he's a part of that, you know, liberal community, yet he is so adamant on prosecuting second and subsequent possession of marijuana as felonies, right? So this is a guy that bangs a drum for liberal, and marijuana is not dangerous, but yet he's vigorously prosecuting these people that his political ideology tells him he shouldn't be. You know, and there's the Bastion case where you can't strike a minority juror unless you have a good reason. In other words, if your client is, let's say, going on trial for some kind of white against black hate crime, you can't strike a black juror unless you have a reason other than the race. And he violates this all the time. He's constantly striking minority jurors without a good reason. So he's very unethical. And, you know, I work with tons of defense attorneys, and I've never heard a good thing about him. And like you said, even if there's, you know, you had the adversarial role of a defense attorney and a prosecutor, usually they could still be cordial at the end of the day. But this is just a guy who's not a good dude. He's a bad dude. And, you know, the interesting thing is Gravely always takes these high-profile cases. He loves to have his picture in the paper. But I think he knows he can't win this. So he probably said, who wants it? Binger said, I'll do it, and Gravely doesn't want anything to do with this prosecution. Because one thing I believe is I don't think they can win. I don't think they can convince 12 people that a 17-year-old kid that was running for his life committed murder when he shot his attackers. I just don't think, you know, you might end up with a hung jury. You might have just two jurors that they just won't bring themselves to say not guilty, and they'll hold out. But this judge is pretty stern, and he's been known to send juries back for hours. Look, get a verdict. I don't want a hung jury. Come up with a verdict. Come up with a verdict. So one thing I could, if I had a farm, I'd bet is there's not going to be a conviction with one of these serious charges. There just won't be. And, you know, the curfew charge should have been dismissed already, because it was ruled by the chief judge that the curfew wasn't even legally enacted. So that'll likely get dismissed at some point. So the only thing we really have to worry about is this possess a dangerous weapon person under 18, which is very ambiguous in its definition. So the jury might do one of those. They might say, hey, let's convict him of this just so we
for
can,
something, yeah.
Yeah, let's give him something, right? I just hope they don't do that with one of the reckless endangering, because that felony could carry with it many years.
Yeah, but I think if he does convict on if the conviction is on the gun charge, I mean, that's certainly, I think, ripe for an appeal. This is where I wanted to kind of close it tonight. We, you know, we've talked about the judge. I think so far, I mean, from what I've seen and from what you shared, I mean, he's appeared to me to be a very fair judge, and you've kind of confirmed that tonight. So I think we're fortunate in that regard to have, because I don't think we don't need a favorite. We don't need a judge to pay for favorites. We just need a judge to enforce the law, and I think we've got one here. And then, so you made your prediction. This is where I wanted to close tonight. That was my prediction as well. I think not guilty. I find it hard to believe that if there's a fair jury, a random jury of his peers, that you're going to find 12 people who are from Kenosha, who were scared to death of what was going on that night, who've now seen the videos or are going to see the videos in court, certainly, and who are going to convict this kid for, well, now he's not a kid anymore, but I mean, who are going to convict him for something that that they were probably grateful to have people like him there for. And they knew what was going on that night. They knew the lawlessness that was going on there in Kenosha those nights, and they were scared, and they knew. And so just to have them, and you know, I can't see a fair jury of people from Kenosha, a unanimous jury, because that's what it takes for a conviction. Yeah. You can have a hung jury, could be split. But for a conviction, you have to have unanimous 12 people who all believe guilty. And I don't see that happening with a fair jury. So then it comes down to jury selection. I mean, if they can steal a presidential election, can they pack a jury pool with people that, you know, that's my worry. And, you know, we'll see I think that's why tomorrow's going to be very interesting, because that's the first part of this case is jury selection.
Yep.
You know, but Kenosha's, it's a big town, but it's a small town. So, I mean, I think, you know, I don't think it's going to be, you know, this isn't Minneapolis. Kenosha's not Minneapolis. I think that we're probably going to have a pretty good idea of who these people on the jury are and where they're, what their background is. So I think that it's hard for me to imagine how he gets convicted. Then again, with everything that's gone on the last year and a half here in America and this post-constitutional America, it's hard for me to imagine that we'd be where we are today. This 50-year leap into fascism from where we were in January of 2019, I mean, or excuse me, January 2020, just prior to COVID. I mean, it's just this 50-year leap forward into socialism, fascism, is communism has been unbelievable to me. But Kevin, I mean, you've been super generous with your time tonight. I'm looking forward to this. For the listeners, we've got quite a live audience tonight. I think this is going to be well received on the podcast. Next week, we'll be talking about what happened this week. We're going to be giving the angles that people won't get from the bullshit news fiction on the TV.
Yeah.
There will be things that were said, the perception that the news media will give you on TV. I guarantee, again, I say this all the time, if you don't watch the news, you're uninformed. If you do watch the news, you're misinformed. They're going to do their best to make it seem like Kyle's guilty, guilty, guilty. Everything's, all the evidence is stacked up against him. And then if he's found not guilty, it's going to be the greatest travesty of justice ever. That's what they'll set it up for. If he's found not guilty, this is going to be the greatest miscarriage of justice. They'll be calling for changes of laws so that this kind of thing doesn't happen again. And people can't get away with murder. I mean, that's what, you know, that's where this is going to go. But that's why we're going to be here to give the angles. You're going to be there in court. And I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be information people literally won't get anywhere else. So.
Yeah, I appreciate having you. And in closing, I'll just say that, you know, Kyle's got two of the sharpest attorneys in the state, so he's in good hands. But he could probably use some prayers for those of us listening at break. You know, this is a kid who's probably scared for his life. I don't know how much it's sunk in yet, but this is a young kid who's got his whole life ahead of him. So I think he needs prayers, good wishes, because he just needs to be able to live out, you know, his late teens and early 20s, you know, without having to, you know, his life is forever changed, but hopefully he can live somewhat of a normal life once this is behind him.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I'm sitting here wondering where this goes from here. I mean, if the persecution that he's gone through, I mean, the stress that him and his family have gone through, I mean, he's already experienced something that none of us would want to have to go through. And yeah, we're sitting here, and you and I are sitting here thinking we can't see how he could get convicted, but we're not the ones sitting here facing, you know, life in prison.
I mean, exactly. And you know what? Binger wants to put this kid in prison. Make no mistake. Binger wants this kid to spend the rest of his life in prison, and that would bring Tom great joy, which is sad, but that's the truth. So hoping it'll turn out in his favor, because if it doesn't, basically that's a referendum on do you have the opportunity or the legal right to use force against somebody who's trying to kill you. It has bad ramifications if somehow there's a guilty verdict, but I'm hopeful that there won't be one.
And maybe we'll save this for a future show, because I want to just speculate, and I kind of want to speculate before the trial gets too far along, but so maybe we'll do it next week. I want to speculate what if Kyle is found not guilty, where does he go from here? Because I have some ideas on that and some thoughts, and I think that might be fun to predict as well, and to spend a little time thinking about what does happen after this if he is acquitted, which we hope and believe that he will be. So I think we'll save that for a future show. And again, Kevin, can't thank you enough. Looking forward to it. And, you know, tomorrow's the day jury selection starts. And next Sunday, 8 o'clock, we'll be here and we'll cover it.
Hopefully we'll have some good news to discuss.
Indeed. Kevin, have a great night. Be well armed.
Thank you so much, Nick. Take care.
Yeah, take care. So Kevin Mathewson, for those of you who joined us later in the show here, criminal defense investigator from Kenosha, two-term Kenosha alderman. He's the editor of the Kenosha County Eye and investigative journalist with Kenosha County Eye. KenoshaCountyEye.com is his website. And I really enjoy his website there, Kenosha County Eye, and it's very, very well read all across the Kenosha County area. It's a outlet that gives you information that you don't get from the mainstream media. I mean, he's had some great stories, uncovered some great things. I mean, again, he's a criminal investigator. He's an investigator. I mean, that's what he does. So, it's good to have his expertise. I think it brings a perspective to the coverage that we're going to have of this show and this trial. And, you know, I talked to Bruce Vilmetti from the Journal earlier this week. He called me and just kind of wanted to get my take on the Kyle Rittenhouse case and trial. And I even had to check my own, you know, I call it FOIC. FOIC is Firearm Owners Inferiority Complex. That it's a term that I came up with. And I think maybe there's even the, you know, CIC. I think there's even some conservative inferiority complex. I think, you know, Bruce asked me, Bruce Vilmetti from the Journal, reporter from the Journal, said, if Kyle is acquitted, what do I think that Wisconsin Carry or any other groups, will we be putting them out there as a hero, or what's in Kyle's future if he's acquitted? And I said to, you know, my instant reaction was that, oh, we shouldn't glorify Kyle for what he had to do to, you know, because taking someone's life isn't. But at the same point, I think maybe we should glorify Kyle for what he did right, which was his passion in, you know, being willing to go to Kenosha to help people out. Look, this is what I say to people. If there's a riot in your town, because this could be you, if you're in Janesville, if you're in Beloit, if you're in Oshkosh, if you're in, you know, Wausau, you could be next. You're one police officer shooting of an individual of a minority away from the news turning you into the next Kenosha, the next, you know, Baltimore, the next Ferguson, the next Minneapolis. I mean, so this could happen in your community. And if it does, if you own a business or if you own a house close to wherever these riots would manifest themselves, you can't protect that business by yourself. You're going to need help from other people. And it's not a difficult thing, or excuse me, it's not an easy thing. True, a gun is a powerful tool, but you can't use a gun to protect property. You can only use a gun to protect yourself. So you have to be the one there to protect your property. And then if someone assaults you, then you can use your gun to defend yourself, but you can't. So if someone throws a brick through the window, the glass storefront of your business, you can't shoot them for that. If someone throws a brick at you, that's a different story. Then you may be able to act in your self-defense, maybe justified. So protecting that's why I've said that we need legislation here. And this is where Republicans need to seize the day, carpe diem, and start pushing legislation. Well, they should have seized the day last year, and they should have been pushing legislation. I called it the Riot Protection Act, to help people. Clearly people need help from the law to be able to protect their business. And what, in that circumstance, my suggestion was that if there's, and I'd even brainstormed it out, if there's a curfew/state of emergency called, if you're facing a threat from multiple attackers, so it couldn't be one or two, but, you know, more than, maybe it's more than three, which the disparity of force is high, you know, and then in that instance, deem it lawful to use deadly force against certain kinds of threats. Example, if anybody is standing off of your property and they're throwing a projectile onto your property, that could be considered a deadly threat. You know, just something, and I didn't brainstorm all the details out, but this is where individuals could use some help from the legislature to protect the rights of law-abiding, protect the rights of the law-abiding. What a novel concept. And so obviously Republicans in Wisconsin didn't feel like doing that. But this is what Democrats would be doing. Democrats would be making hay. They do make hay with these kinds of situations. And we as conservatives, you know, while I really don't think Kyle will be lionized for killing someone, for what his family has had to go through, I think their experience is going to be quite something to share. The media attacks, Kyle Rittenhouse being called a white supremacist. I mean, there is no evidence of that. And if you know Lynn Wood with the situation that happened out in the protests in D.C. where there was the students who were accused of berating, accosting a Native American protester out there. And then they got a large settlement from the major networks for their inaccurate and wrongful portrayal of, and I forget the name of the, it's on the tip of my tongue here, but the name of the kid that was out there in those protests or those demonstrations in D.C. where that was caught by the major networks, that encounter between, I wish I could remember the kid's name. But so anyway, Lynn Wood was part of that. I could see right when this happened, Kyle Rittenhouse was characterized as a white supremacist by Gwen Moore, a sitting congresswoman. Channel 12, I believe, was putting that, reporting that. I don't know the extent, the laws with regard to slander and defamation, but that's one angle where I could see this going after the trial is over, is some of those outlets that were reporting on Kyle as a white supremacist, which there is no that's it. Sandman. Even you're always there with Nick Sandman. He was the one that got a big settlement from the networks for their portrayal of him in their inaccurate portrayal of him in that incident out in D.C. But that's what one thing I could see is some litigation against some of the media outlets that were quick to, you know, call Kyle a white supremacist, which there's, again, no evidence of. I could see Kyle being a Joe the Plumber-like figure in the conservative movement. But we'll save that for a future broadcast to talk about. See if I had anything else in my notes here this week. You know, we covered so much there. I think that's where we'll leave it. I had a few other topics to throw out here tonight, but we went through so much today. We're about an hour and 20 minutes into the show, so I think we'll leave it there. And looking forward to next week. The majority of the coverage here, majority of the topics here for Well-Armed Radio are probably going to be just focused on the trial. I think there'll be enough content to do the hour and a half every Sunday night. So 8 o'clock next Sunday is likely. Well, not likely. It's going to be, I believe, next week the time changes. I think it is. So I guess fall back next Sunday. So the unfortunate time of year when it starts getting dark at 5 o'clock here in Wisconsin, which is super depressing. It's bad enough when it's dark at like 6 now. But here, what do you would like happen if Kyle Rittenhouse was not white and did the same thing? Just curious. Look, I truly, and you know, people can believe this or not, like, I don't judge people by the color of their skin. When I see, black conservatives, when I see black entrepreneurs who aren't out there trying to, you know, suck off government grants and other things, I just find that so impressive. So it doesn't matter the color of a person's skin. If Kyle Rittenhouse was black and the people he shot was white, it wouldn't change my analysis of the situation whatsoever. And I think that's what we need to get to in this country, where we don't judge people on the color of their skin. Because right now it seems like all we do is judge people on the color of their skin. When I say we, I'm talking about the popular culture, the media. And now we're getting back to intentional segregation. I mean, I think we're going the wrong direction in this country, as many other people feel as well. And And, you know, it's unfortunate. So anyway, that's the show. Thank everybody for tuning in. And, you know, next week, live here, we'll take some calls. If anybody's got questions about things that happened with the trial or anything else, and we'll go from there. Have a great week. Carry on. Be well armed.
This is Sniper Chick Julie. You've been listening to Well Armed Radio, and I have to know, is that a gun in your pants, or did you just really enjoy the show?
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.